All right, here we go. We have two big stories that we're following today. Both involve the deaths of many, many innocent people. Remember that plane crash in India that we told you about? I think we've got a better idea now of what caused it. And you're also going to be able to see and hear it for yourself. It's really a fascinating part of the story. In the other story, we now know how the U.S. and Israel tricked Iran into thinking they had until Sunday to negotiate. In fact, here's President Trump all but admitting to this.
Gave Iran chance after chance to make a deal. Certain Iranian hardliners spoke bravely, but they didn't know what was about to happen. They're all dead now, and it will only get worse.
So you listen to what he says right there, right? He says the following, right? I gave Iran chance after chance. They're all dead now, and it will get worse. As you hear those words, does that sound like somebody who didn't know what Israel was doing? See, here's the thing. Iran was made to believe that they would not be attacked so long as they continued negotiating. So they agreed, and they said, we're going to meet on Sunday. And it seemed like the whole world was fooled. I was fooled. I thought, okay, we're good till maybe Monday. Unfortunately for them, it was a trick. It was a lie. And not the first. Not by a long shot. I'm Rick Sanchez. Let's talk about this. I want to start with this. In 1831, U.S. President Andrew Jackson tricked Native Americans in the South into signing a deal to take away their land in exchange for some land somewhere else. Of course, when the Cherokees, most of whom who died on the way there, finally got to where they were going to claim this land that they thought they were given, it wasn't there. It was a trick. And this happened time and time and time again. This is Andrew Jackson. Let me put a picture up. There he is. There he is, attired on a horse, and now you're about to see him in his White House portrait. There it is. Look at that, looking regal, right? He was a notorious, quote, Indian hater. His was one of about 400 tricks or broken treaties or lies that the U.S. government engaged in during the expansion of America. You could actually say, right, that America was built on lies and broken promises during that era. Look, as Americans, this is not something that we're proud of, even as we accept that it's part of our history. But is it only part of our history? Is it only part of our history, or is it part of the present as well? Let me show you somebody else. This is James Baker. See that guy? In 1990, he told Russia/Soviet leaders that if they agreed to German reunification, he would promise them that NATO would absolutely not encroach on the Soviet Union or Russia. The U.S. and Russia would be friends from now on. And NATO would not threaten Russia, quote, not one inch eastward. That's the famous line, not one inch eastward, right? That's what James Baker was quoted as saying. As it turns out, it was a trick. It was a lie. How do we know that? Because just a few years later, NATO claimed Poland, and then Hungary, and then the Czech Republic. 2004, moved into Bulgaria, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Romania, Slovakia, Slovenia. It was broken promise after broken promise after broken promise until they started to move on Ukraine. With military infrastructure, no doubt, weapons. Brazen military exercises right off the coast of Russia. Look it up. It's still on the Googles, right? And eventually a coup to remove a democratically elected president. See a pattern? And that's when Russia finally said, enough, niet. We also know, because of declassified documents now, it wasn't just James Baker. Everybody always talks about James Baker, who lied about NATO. I'm going to give you a list of some of the others who knew, according to new documents that have been revealed. People who told Mikhail Gorbachev false assurances. President George Bush, Germany's Helmut Kohl, U.S. Secretary Council Chief Robert Gates. Remember these people. French President François Mitterrand. God, his name is fun to say. U.K. Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher. British Foreign Secretary Douglas Hurd. Prime Minister John Major. NATO Secretary General Manfred Warner. All of these people. So what some denied or described as an oversight is now clearly shown to be an orchestrated deception. And once again, see a pattern here? I have to ask. Knowing that history, what are the Iranians to make of this sneak attack? Because now we're really in the present, that they were fooled or lulled into believing was not going to happen, was not coming. But maybe a more important question is this. Who will believe what they hear from Washington the next time Washington says, trust us? I'm going to be discussing that in just a little bit with Pepe Escobar. He's a Brazilian journalist who's made his mark on the non-corporate media world and done so in a really big way. And he's going to have a lot to say about this. But before we go to Pepe, let's do this. Before we go to him, I want to bring in correspondent Maria Finocchina, who has been covering this story very well, by the way, and with danger to herself, as a lot of people are who are covering this situation. She's been covering it from the outset. So, Maria, I hope you're well. As I bring you in, I'm just wondering. So Israel has attacked Iran. Now Iran is attacking Israel. Are both sides' missiles getting through? And where is this heading?
Hello to you, Rick. First of all, let me tell you that it's an honor to be part of your show. And quick heads up, people, I have to warn you that if there is an emergency alert on my phone, I will have to run to the nearest underground shelter, which is a solid 6-minute walk away. So this is the reality we live in. Mm-hmm. I will not definitely have time to apologize if that received. So I do it now. So you are warned right now. And getting back to your question, yeah, it's the fourth day of Israel's war with Iran, and by local standards, I have to tell you, this feels like the apocalypse from here, because yes, Israel has seen barrages of rockets in many nights and days, like the one we had tonight before, but under fire from Hamas, based in Gaza, Hezbollah in Lebanon, the Houthis in Yemen. Even Iran itself, last year, if you remember, in April and October, the countries already exchanged fire. But this, well, this is different. This time it feels like serious. It feels like the war people always feared but never truly believed would happen. Until now, Israel's defense systems, maybe you probably heard about them, the most famous Iron Dome, David Sling. I mean, they were doing great their job. Interceptions were high, casualties were low. People grew used to it. And I mean, even like the world would be watching Israeli people and saying, oh, they're tough, because, I mean, some of them even got a little too relaxed. And there was time not long ago, a month ago, when sirens meant grabbing your phone and heading not to the shelter, but to the balcony, filming the intercepts like a show in the sky. Imagine that. Now, not anymore the case. When people receive an emergency alert right now, they jump out of bed, grabbing kids, pads, pillows, running to shelters. Like, you see these scenes during the night when we go there. By the way, we go there by bicycle because it's faster, just to save some time. We see people like rushing. We've never seen that before. And by the way, we live on a street where every building has so-called underground, and every unit has a so-called safe room. But people, I mean, they stop relying on this anymore. They go to proper public fortified underground shelters because they've seen it on TV, Iranian missiles leveling entire apartment blocks, like direct hits on residential neighborhoods. And, you know, because why? Because it's different right now. What's coming from Iran is ballistic. It covers, yes, like missiles cover the distance of 1,500 kilometers. It's long range. And by the way, it's not Iron Dome protecting Israel anymore. It's Arrow and Thaad, American system. But even best systems have limits. And with this amount of rockets coming from Iran, I mean, every perfect system has limits, as I said. So yeah, they come through, and we see what we see, direct hits. So, and speaking about people, like, they are in, okay, they're calm, but still in more panic than before, because they don't understand what's going on. And The worst thing is that they don't understand where it's going, well, because the Israeli leadership actually sending mixed messages. I mean, they say, what's the goal of this operation? They started by saying, we will not allow Iran to have nuclear weapons. But we've seen them from day one, from minute one, targeting military bases and missile spots. I mean, they don't even want Iran to have future, like potential nuclear weapons. They want to destroy their existing military system and military capabilities. That's absolutely clear. And then now we hear about regime change. This is something that Bibi Netanyahu said clearly, talking and addressing Iranian people, like calling them to rise up and saying, hey, people, join us in our fight. But, I mean, because you don't like your rulers anymore. Anyway, yeah, so no one knows how it will end and when. What should happen so that we can say, like, okay, it's over, like everybody's happy now. So there is no clear goal declared. They say defeat enemy, but what exactly does it mean? No one knows.
What I want to ask you about is, you live there. I mean, you talk to people in Israel. What is going on in their minds as they see this? We've known for years that Bibi Netanyahu has been salivating to have a war with Iran. It's starting to look like this is the real deal. This is a war with Iran. So the people, 50% of them don't like Netanyahu. The other 50% like him because he's a tough guy. What are they saying about this eventual war that now they're actually feeling and seeing on the streets of their own neighborhoods?
Well, first of all, Rick, you have to understand, while Bibi Netanyahu is saying that Israel is waging a war against existential threat, people are feeling this existential threat with these Iranian missiles that started happening after Israel started this operation as a retaliation. So now they literally feel this existential threat. So they do not have enough time anymore to think about politics, to think about how good Bibi Netanyahu is as a ruler. They think about how to save their lives. Mm. They think about their kids. They think about their parents. And this is what I see on their faces when we sit with them and wait for the army to tell us you can get out of shelter. And I mean, I look at them and they're smiling. They like, you know, there is this vibe as if everything is good because everybody's trying to pretend it's normal while it's not. So yeah, but this is what preoccupies people right now.
But hold on.
But you have to understand
I got to ask you a question about that, because here's my curiosity. We get a sense that the Israeli people are almost, well, cocky, confident. We have America on our side. Mm. We've got most of Europe on our side. We've got the best military in the history of the world. We got nukes. We don't have to worry about anything. Why should we be scared? We're not scared of anything. So I ask you, do they look scared now?
They do look scared, and they do look, let's put it, surprised, and they did not expect that this. I mean, everybody was talking about Iran jumping in and stepping in, joining the war first, I mean, to help Hamas, then to Hezbollah, like everybody was talking about this. But Iran was distancing itself. Well, the war was waged through its proxies, so Iran was not directly there, but everybody was like talking about this. But I think no one expected what it means, actually, when ballistic missiles, 30 or 50 or 100 of them, flying to your country like at the same time. And, I mean, no defense system can protect you 100%. And for now, as we speak, like 24 people have been killed since Friday. Mm. And more than 600 injured, hospitals overwhelmed, emergency teams exhausted. And this is why people are, I mean, they do look scared, as you said, but they are scared. They don't just look scared. They are afraid. And they're like, okay, what's going on? We didn't expect that. Why is our country not protecting us anymore? This is the line that runs through their heads. And you have to understand, speaking about like how it ends, We heard from Donald Trump that he keeps talking about the deal that the sides should strike right now, as if like this word, the deal, has some personal magic for Mr. Trump. You know, like he's talking about deals all the time.
Yes.
Ukraine, Russia, okay, deal. Tehran, Washington, deal. But man, now everybody understands, at least here in Israel, and I'm pretty sure something tells me that in Iran as well, that Israel has a plan and it's sticking to it. And the plan is solid. And the leadership has said since the beginning, I mean, this campaign, this operation will continue as long as needed, as many days or weeks or months as needed. So stop dreaming. There will be no deal. When we're done, we will talk. And this is the mood. And also another thing, very important, like why would Netanyahu stop now? Even if Iran comes and say, hey, we give up, take everything, like we follow Libyan scenario, like you wanted us. This is what Bibi Netanyahu said in April, like take all our weapons, just stop bombing us. Why would Netanyahu stop now? He's been dreaming about this. You said this for decades.
Yeah.
It's been career defining mission for him for years. And plus, let's not forget that just days before this operation started on Friday, he was about to face political collapse because opposition parties were preparing to vote to dissolve Knesset. So, I mean, why would he stop right now? Now he's leading Israel through historic war against Iran, something he's been dreaming about. So why would he stop now? And this is the scariest thing, and everybody here understands that. But I think it's like 3 days, 4 days is too short for, I mean, let's give people more time to understand what's going on, to assess the situation. Maybe then they will react and they will come to the streets, maybe even like, although gatherings are prohibited right now, but maybe they will like raise their voice and say they are happy or not. Now we don't even hear their opinion because they are preoccupied with their lives.
You are gutsy. You are intrepid. You are on top of the situation. You provide great insight. Masha, well done. We are we're happy to have you there, being able to share with us this information in such a difficult time and in a difficult situation. Our best to you. Thank you so much. As we go to break, I want to remind you that there's a huge update on that Air India crash that we told you about. In fact, it's on this video. We saw it before, but we didn't hear it. Watch this video again. See, there's something about that video that nobody listened for in the past, but we're hearing it now, and I'm going to tell you exactly what it is. Or also, we're going to be joined by Pepe Escobar. Just how big might this war get, and who else might get involved? This is what people all over the world are asking themselves. I'm Rick Sanchez. This is The Sanchez Effect, and we're going to be right back.
Towards the end of the 18th century, a wave of decolonization caused the colonizers to focus their attention on Africa.
A period marked by the brutal legacy of European imperialism and the systematic exploitation of African peoples and resources.
Many of our nations remain caught in the grip of neo-colonial systems.
Africans must be the lords of their own land, the masters of their own resources.
It is time to leave Africa and other developing countries alone. The West needs to stop with the foreign interference.
They know that a divided Africa is a weak Africa.
Let us challenge the poisonous tongues that seek to divide us and build bridges of understanding instead.
Today, that opportunity lies in cooperation with nations across the global south and with allies like Russia.
And welcome to Crosstalk Bullhorns. Here, we discuss some real news.
When all truths seem wrong, when all rules just don't hold, and a new world is yet to shape out, disdain becomes the etiquette, and engagement equals betrayal. When so many find themselves worlds apart, we choose to look for common ground.
Welcome back to the Sanchez Effect. This is where we practice smart, factual, analytical journalism. So I want you to listen to this statement that Mr. Netanyahu has just made, and you tell me what you think.
Tonight I wish to speak to you, the proud people of Iran. And the time has come for you to unite around your flag and your historic legacy by standing up for your freedom from an evil and oppressive regime. It has never been weaker. This is your opportunity to stand up and let your voices be heard.
You see what he's doing there? He's trying to get the people of Iran to revolt against their government. Pepe Escobar is one of the most distinguished journalists we know. He's an independent journalist, which means a lot these days because it means he's not fed information by some corporation. And I'm asking Pepe, and I'm asking you who are watching us here, are you as confused as I am? I thought this was about Israel trying to get Iran to stop their nuclear program, and now you have Mr. Netanyahu coming out and saying, no, 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 it's about something else. I'm just trying to get regime change because I need them to overthrow their leadership there. Is it nuclear change or is it regime change? Which is it, Pepe?
First of all, Rick, pleasure to be with you.
Thank you.
Second, this was never about JCPOA, the Iranian nuclear program, or a new JCPOA patronized by Trump. It's about regime change. And it has been like that since the 90s. Mm. This is a very long story. Started with the neocons when they were out of power in the late 90s, during the second Clinton administration. Netanyahu was working with them. They had papers, they issued papers. And after 9/11, General Wesley Clark, I think our audience, everybody knows about the famous seven countries in 5 years.
Yeah, the Jeffrey Sachs.
Everybody
plan.
Knows that. Right. Exactly. Yeah. Jeffrey Sachs now is referring to this all the time.
All the time, yeah.
Absolutely. And all of us who were covering Washington, in Washington or around, we knew what that meant. And that's exactly what happened.
And remind us, Syria, Iraq, Yemen.
Afghanistan. Yeah. It started with Afghanistan.
And most of them have already been, it's worked.
Absolutely. Destruction of Libya, destruction of Syria, and the cherry on the cake, of course, is Iran. And that's exactly what's happening now.
So
they waited 25 years for this.
This is the end of the rainbow for
him. Yes, it's literally the end of the rainbow.
For Mr. Netanyahu.
They have been waiting for this for, to be exact, 27 years, since 1998. And now they have it in front of them, and it's slipping away.
But those places that we just mentioned are, I don't want to make them sound not as important, but they're not the same as Iran.
They are very important in themselves, but the regional power and the most important nation, which is a civilization state, remember the Persian Empire, in West Asia, is Iran. Why Iran? Because they need to break up BRICS from the inside. Our audience should always remember the top three BRICS today are Russia, China, and Iran.
Yes.
India, not at all, because India, they don't even know what they are at the moment. Mm-hmm. Very complicated story.
South Africa, Brazil, important, but
they
not
are
the
not, no, they, okay. they, no, no, they are not as important as these three, because these three are coordinating what we call Eurasia integration, which is the Eurasia mass coordinated by three civilization states in a network of connectivity corridors. And then you have the Chinese New Silk Roads, you have the North-South transportation corridor, which is Russia, Iran, and India. All that. So how do you break it up? You start a regional war.
Let me ask you the $100,000 million question. Right. How is it that a country this big with a blowhard leader can control the entire world and dictate to the United States of America what it needs to do or will do without even having to ask permission?
Rick, your excellent question is posed by the whole global South. You hear this question from Nigeria to Indonesia and everything, everywhere in between.
Seems almost ludicrous.
It is, but when you know Washington, you know how Washington works, and you know who controls the levers of power in Washington.
Whoever pays, that's the answer to your question.
And who controls the international financial system? That's even more important.
Israel. Yeah.
Or affiliated with Israel.
Or Zionists, hardcore Zionists,
right,
which
right.
is even worse.
Because it's not, people say Jewish, it's not Jewish. Some of the biggest protests in America are Jews. Some of the biggest protests against Netanyahu are in Israel.
Exactly, exactly. It's, we can define them as a Zionist axis. It's very hard to, I cannot give a short definition in 5 seconds, but it includes silos of power inside the deep state in the U.S.,
yeah.
CIA, the National Security Council, industrial military complex, what we call the Beltway, Virginia, Maryland, Washington, New York, which is the financial connection, and the Atlanticist connection to capitals in Europe, especially London, Paris, and Berlin, and European Central Bank in Frankfurt. This is the network. And we have a lot of very important Zionists, committed Zionists, not Jews, not progressive Jews.
No, 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 no. It's nothing to do with religion. Right.
But committed Zionists who subscribe to this agenda since 1998, American neocons, Bibi Netanyahu, and the hardcore node, which is now in power in Tel Aviv.
You just said something a little while ago.
By the way, let me bring you up to date. There's an update that just crossed just a little while ago, and I'm going to read it to you as I read it to our viewers who are watching us. This is breaking news. Israeli fighter jets have just launched attacks on a densely populated residential area of eastern Tehran. Mm-hmm. Iranian Press TV says it's happening right now. RT's Iranian bureau, our bureau, right,
yes,
of course, there, and they're monitoring the situation. And they are being warned that this is starting to get really hot and heavy. What significance does this have to you?
Let me try to give it a one-minute explanation.
Yeah.
This is the Beirut scenario. The scenario that the IDF applied on Beirut, which was destroying, I would say, at least half of the Dahiye neighborhood, which is in southern Beirut, very close to the airport. Mm-hmm. We were there a few months ago because I went there to see the funeral of Sheikh Nasrallah. And they took me around the neighborhood, and half of it was hit by Israel.
So how do you compare this to Beirut? You mean the recent attacks on Beirut or the...
No, the attacks 3, 4, 5 months ago.
Exactly.
Exactly. Okay. So they want to replicate the Beirut scenario. And one of the IDF generals, he actually said, we're going to turn Tehran into Beirut. In the past few hours.
So when Israel's been
attacking civilians.
But that's what I was just going to say. Yes. According to our RT reporters and correspondents, they're telling us that Israel has been going around saying they're attacking our civilians, but we're not attacking their civilians. We're only hitting military targets.
Spin. Absolutely. Yeah. And that's the problem, because the only thing that they really know what to do, genocide in Gaza, mm-hmm. is to attack harmless civilians or to unleash hell from above. When they see a counterpower, and now they see what it is to have a confrontation against a real power, even if Iran was crippled in the first 10 to 12 hours because they hacked the military grid and the electronic communications.
Well, this is Pearl Harbor. It took the United States 3 years.
Rick, very important. Yeah. It took 10 hours with the best technicians in Iran to put the grid back together. And there was Russian help. Mm. We know via our Iranian connections. The Russians helped technically to get the military grid back on track. And now you see the response.
Let me ask you, there's so much that we need to talk about. Let's go there, since you just mentioned Russia. Mm. This puts Vladimir Putin in a difficult situation.
Extremely difficult.
Because he is being asked by Donald Trump to help him solve this dilemma. He needs to remain loyal, and always has struck me as a guy who is loyal to the people who have been loyal to him.
Absolutely.
He probably wants to remain, at my read, I'm not in the man's brain, but I would expect he wants to remain loyal to Iran, while he also knows that if he gives a little bit to Donald Trump, Donald Trump can help remove some of the obstacles so he can finally end this stupid war in Ukraine. He's in a catch-22.
It's very, very difficult.
Well, did I get that right?
You did, Rick. Maybe we're going to have a glimpse of an answer Friday in St. Petersburg, because Putin is going to be at the plenary session, and there's going to be a Q&A after that. Everybody is waiting for Friday.
Yeah.
What is he going to say about that? Because this is going to be the main theme in St.
Petersburg. We know he's talking to Trump, apparently.
They're
having phone calls.
They had another phone call.
Yeah.
And Trump is spinning that Putin could be the mediator between Israel and Iran. That poses a very complicated question. Don't forget that Iran and Russia have a strategic partnership, which was approved by the Majlis, the Iranian parliament, yesterday. How can you be a mediator between your strategic partner and a very dubious friend, enemy?
It doesn't make sense at all. It gets a little weird, this whole thing.
And that's obviously Putin, because he's very legalistic, he's thinking, how am I going to extricate myself from this role?
But from Russia's standpoint, it's good that he's prominent. This gives him prominence.
He doesn't need that kind of prominence.
Well, he spent 4 years without talking to the U.S. president. Now the U.S. president's calling him on the phone. But they're like they're buddies.
This is very tricky. Trump is trying to force Putin to do something that Putin doesn't want to do.
That's a great point.
Putin would never take this initiative himself.
Yes.
So he has to play Trump's game. You know, nobody plays Putin.
I was just going to say, I don't take Putin for a stooge or a guy who's not going to know
blessing
the game.
Blessing on earth,
He may be a lot of things, but he's not that.
No,
he's not. He's a smart guy.
And there's an extra...
And he's as Machiavellian as the next guy if he has to
Absolutely.
Be, I'm sure.
And Rick, there's an extra element which the security services here, the intelligence nomenclatura in Moscow, they are starting to ask themselves questions about how come Operation Spiderweb attacking our strategic bombers is exactly the same modus operandi of those trucks with drones inside Iran. If the investigation goes deeper, because it could be the other way around. Because from the beginning, this could have been a Mossad plot sold to the MI6, who sold it to the SBU in Kiev.
Everybody in the world knows this whole situation with Ukraine is silly. And Donald Trump said he would do what's necessary to end it on day one.
This is what he says.
Instead, he's almost conflagrated it in such a way so that he can do something else, Iran situation.
Sure.
So that, in other words, he now has a lever that he can play against Russia, it looks like.
Of course, because the big picture, everything that we're discussing.
And do you think that's what's happening? You think the United States...
It is.
Like maybe somebody in the White House, maybe even Donald Trump said, hey, let's solve this thing once and for all. Let's get rid of the sanctions against Russia. Let's negotiate with Russia. Let's become... let's get on friendly terms with Russia. And let's worry about the rest of it. And somebody said, no, don't do that. We need the Russians because of what's about to happen in Iran.
Of course.
Or am I too cynical?
The deep state will never renounce their forever war against Russia, their proxy war in Ukraine that they are losing. But they will never admit that they are losing, and they will lose it. This is very serious because I think the heart of the whole, the heart of the chessboard, you know, the definitive moves in the chessboard. There are two forever wars going on. Forever wars is how we define the Washington modus operandi, the industrial military complex modus operandi. In the black soil of Novorossiya, which they are losing in Ukraine, proxy war, and now a proxy war between the US and Iran, fought by Israel.
Correct.
Obviously, the last thing the Americans want is to say that we are part of this war. No, they want to Israel do the fighting. The problem is the Iranian reaction, especially the last 48 hours, and apparently tonight there's going to be the mother of all missile attacks. They are already preparing Iranian public opinion.
Whose missile attacks against whom?
Iran attacking Israel with their latest hypersonic missiles, which they haven't used yet. And they are promising this for tonight.
So this thing
IRGC.
will really blow up.
It's enormous.
This thing is going to escalate if that happens.
So now Trump is in an even more uncomfortable position than Putin. If he jumps into the war, he loses the MAGA base.
Yes.
He already lost, as you know well, he already lost.
My friend Tucker came out this weekend and criticized the hell out of him.
Absolutely.
Colonel McGregor is criticizing.
Exactly.
Scott Ritter is criticizing him. You are criticizing him.
There you go. He already lost over half of the MAGA base because they're not Zionists.
Right.
Exactly.
And they also were promised that this would not be a war presidency, and so far it looks like a war presidency.
No, he owns two wars now.
Yeah.
Whatever he does, now he owns Israel's war. Israel imposed a war on him, and he doesn't know what to do.
Brilliant.
This is the short outtake.
Will a U.S. president turn their back on an Israeli prime minister, and will Trump be the first to do that? That's the $100 million question.
It is, Rick, but it's not him. Even if his instinct would say, if I get into this war, I'm cooked.
Yes.
But he's being forced by these silos in the deep state everywhere. You have to do it, because this is America's national policy, and you are facing an existential threat. By the way, very important.
But it could be the end of Israel.
It could be the end of Israel. There was a very important meeting in Wall Street over 10 days ago, more or less. Steve Witkoff was there.
Yeah.
Do you know what he said? Iranian ballistic missiles are a threat to America. This is crazy. This is the he's already legitimizing an attack.
That's Netanyahu's playbook.
And he was a negotiator until five minutes before he was negotiating with Araghchi, the Iranian foreign minister.
To be clear,
yeah,
with the exception of words, which, you know, sticks and stones can break my bones, but words can never hurt me, right? Has Iran ever threatened or attacked the United States?
Never.
Right.
Never, never.
So what are we talking about?
Exactly.
They're not a threat to my country at all.
It's not a threat to the U.S., and it's not a threat to the West.
Yeah.
Very, very important. Iran wants to be what they were, what the Persian Empire, and then later they were throughout most of history, a very important West Asia and Eurasian power. A regional power. It's different. And they have, of course, very good connections everywhere. For instance, the relationship between Iran and Pakistan now is excellent.
Yeah.
Pakistan is not Shiite. I'll give you an example for our audience.
And they're actually warmer relations with Saudi Arabia, too, by the way. I just wanted to throw that in there compared to what they have.
Very, very important.
Yes. And
Mohammed bin Salman, he understands that he needs a good relationship with Iran because they need a balance in West Asia. You know what's happening as we speak? There were 20,000 Iranian pilgrims that went to the Hajj in Saudi Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
They are stranded because Iran closed their airspace. You know what Pakistan is doing? They are hosting these 20,000 people, providing everything for them while they cannot travel back to Iran. This is friendship between peoples, really, you know.
This is the final part of our conversation. Mm. Have you seen the Bibi Files? It's a documentary. It's on YouTube. Everybody can see it. It's the history of why Bibi Netanyahu became such a hardliner.
You mean Milekovsky, no?
Yeah, it's a pretty amazing piece of work. And
okay.
It shows as well, I think, that Bibi Netanyahu feels, and it goes point by point, if he doesn't do this, if he's not a war president or a war prime minister, he will be defeated and dragged out of office and he will go to jail.
And he'll go to jail.
Why this is happening.
Exactly.
Do you agree with that?
Absolutely, absolutely. But if it was not Bibi, it would be another one. It would be Katz, the current defense minister.
Well, what the documentary,
they're all BBs.
What the documentary says is Bibi had to go there, but because of his corruption trial, if he doesn't go there, he goes to jail.
He goes to jail.
So he had to go all the way to one side and say, I am the guy who protects this country.
It's the only way, yeah, exactly, a bigger war.
Merritt wouldn't be like that.
A bigger war is the only way for him to survive, not go to jail, and political career doesn't end. But it's, from the point of view of big powers, what's going on now has the potential to rearrange the chessboard in ways that nobody thought about, in fact. Because if Iran manages to destroy Israel's economy. Okay, 30 seconds of information. Israel has one oil refinery already attacked. The power plant connected to the oil refinery in Haifa disappeared. They have three ports. One of them is bankrupt, Eilat. The other one, Ashdod, still more or less, but it's a small port. And Haifa is on fire. And they have one airport which is being attacked. If you immobilize these three nodes, you cut off the Israeli economy from the global economy. Simple as that.
Not to mention, can you say global energy crisis? Could be around the corner.
No, the global energy crisis would be a different scenario, Rick, because that would be if the Americans entered the war, and something that Iran was deliberating until this morning, and they postponed the decision for 2 days, to close the Strait of Hormuz. If they close the Strait of Hormuz, I was there last month.
Yes.
I was at the Bandar Abbas port, and I the guys were showing us. I was like, okay, the Strait of Hormuz is that way, right? They said, yes, but it's 39 kilometers away from where we are. But when I was flying from Bandar Abbas to the Iran-Pakistani border, we fly over Hormuz Island. And right after Hormuz Island is the Strait of Hormuz. It's over there, you know, literally.
So if they shut that down?
They can shut it down in a matter of hours.
And what happens to the world's energy supply?
What happens to the... Is that in terms of a barrel of oil, Goldman Sachs, years ago, in their different projections, at the time we were publishing that, I was with Asia Times in Hong Kong, we published that Goldman Sachs studies. Oil could go in the first few days to 150 or 200, and over a few weeks could get to 500.
Wow. People paying $10 a gas in the United States. Goodbye, Trump.
Even worse, Rick, that gigantic multi-trillion pile of derivatives, which is the hidden secret of the international financial system, collapses completely, which means the global economy, at least the Western part, collapses completely.
Wow.
These are realist scenarios.
Yeah,
these are.
Yeah. Well, let's see how this plays out. Obviously, if Iran. The interesting thing I think about this is something that you hit on. And we think historically about countries, 9/11, countries that were attacked, and it took them a while to find their footing. You know, Pearl Harbor, the United States, another example. Where
well,
it took
this,
them a while.
From an Iranian point of view, they saw it as a Pearl Harbor. They were not expecting an attack like this.
So you're saying it's going to take them a while to find their footing, but be careful when they do.
They are already finding it, Rick. And it was very fast. Nobody thought that after that shock and awe, Israeli style, which the playbook is the American shock and awe in 2003.
Right.
It's the same thing. So they will be incapacitated and they will lose the war in 48 hours. No. They were back in less than 48 hours. And now they are... Can you imagine replacing all the leadership of the IRGC in a matter of hours and these guys are on the job? And now they're saying... They said it early this morning. Yeah, our mandate is to keep going and we can... With the missiles that we have, we can continue to bomb at the rate we're bombing for 6 months.
This could get scary, Pepe.
It could get really
scary.
It is. I would like to, for you and for our audience, I cannot stress enough how serious is the situation at the moment. And the problem is that we have, for instance, on one side, we have the Iranian government, everything that we may not agree with it, but they are rational actors.
Yes.
Putin is a rational actor.
Yes.
Xi Jinping is a rational actor. Trump is a volatile actor. And those people in Tel Aviv are completely irrational actors.
Yes. And I think if you looked at the last 10 years throughout this argumental crisis that's been taking place between these two countries, the one who has been most rational has been Tehran. I must admit, just looking at it as a journalist, as an American journalist from the outside.
Of course.
So that's the facts.
And when you go there and talk to them, Rick, I was there last month. And, of course, they love when we foreigners go there and we ask questions and we understand their culture, etc. I went everywhere from the Caspian to the Persian Gulf. You know, they gave me a crew. We started to shoot a documentary about the International North-South Transportation Corridor. All the way to the Iran-Pakistani border, which I crossed by boat. I crossed the border, but by boat. Overland is very difficult. You know who's crossing the border now? Trucks from Pakistan to Iran carrying Chinese hardcore.
It's a different world, isn't it?
Yeah. For Iran. And they crossed that border.
Speaking of BRICS, exactly. Pepe, what a delight. You are such
great.
You are such an interesting person, such incredible wisdom, great insight. Real journalist, thank you for sharing that insight.
Thank you very much.
And let's not stop this. I want to talk to you regularly.
We should.
I really appreciate it. By the way,
thank you.
I promised I'd give the latest on this story. So here's the latest on that horrible crash
of Air India's Boeing 787. There's new information discovered when experts began listening to the plane as it started to crash. I want you to listen to this now. This is a telltale sign, say the experts. It's a sound. Let me play it for you here several times. Did you hear that? Doesn't that sound not unlike a regular plane engine? That's what the experts say. They say it sounds more like a drone or a small prop plane, and they study this stuff. You know why? Because what you're hearing is a small propeller which deploys on all planes when there is some type of hydraulic or other type of power failure, and it's designed to help the plane land. This is what it looks like. Let's put it up. Yeah, you're going to see it there at the very bottom of this thing. It's called a ram air turbine. Ram, right? A rat, pardon me. And that's what it looks like when it deploys. See it right there? Automatically, when the plane's computer senses that there's a failure, a catastrophic failure, they see the problem and they immediately put that down. That says a lot. Experts are now reporting that they heard and saw evidence that the prop or that turbine deployment that I just showed you, which is a clear sign that there was some kind of catastrophic system failure on this plane. How about that? Sources I've spoken to, by the way, just this morning told me today that based on new information that's coming out about this plane's condition prior to and during takeoff, quote, the pilot should have chosen to reject the takeoff. Huge mistake. Of course, we're going to continue to follow this investigation as we see that the investigators start to reconstruct this crash. Final note, remember when we were covering the crash and we mentioned it was impossible for people on the ground to not have been hurt or killed? Well, we're now getting numbers, and we're told at least 29 people, non-passengers, were also killed on the ground, and that number is likely going to rise. So much for us being able to watch this situation. We're going to continue to do it for you. That's the Sanchez Effect, where we bring you the news raw, real, honest, like this guy, raw, real, honest, without borders and without corporate masters. I'm Rick Sanchez, and we'll be looking for you next time. Thanks again, my friend.
Thank you, Rick. That was really good. I see it was good.
It was a good conversation.
It was what, 15 minutes?
I don't know. It was the longest I've ever gone.
No, it was good.